MacCast, Tuesday, July 26th, 2011. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hey, you know what? It is my birthday today. I think I've now made this a tradition of somehow ending up recording a MacCast on my birthday, and I can't think of a better way to celebrate than to spend some time with you talking about Mac, Apple, and geek stuff. I love doing this thing, and I've been doing it for about 6 years now, so I obviously wouldn't keep doing something that long if I didn't really love it. So we have a great show for you today. As you probably can guess, we're going to focus a lot on Lion, talk a little bit about some of Apple's new hardware they released last week. But really, I want to dive into some of the tips and tricks and things that I have been discovering now that I've been using Lion for about a week. Had some time to really dive into certain areas of it, and I'm going to share some of my insights, some of the information that I found through reading the blogs and stuff that I have been pouring through, just trying to learn as much as I can about Lion. So hopefully I'm going to share a lot of information with you. For those of you who are not upgraded to Lion yet and thinking about upgrading, it'll probably be a good primer, just some thoughts and ideas about how I feel about the new operating system, how my transition went, how I did my transition, and all that sort of stuff. So stay tuned. We're going to dive into everything. But before I get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, Smile Software. I want to talk to you today about PDF Pen. This is an application, because I do a lot online now and working in my business, also along with the podcasting, I do some web development. And so I work for a lot of clients that are virtual. I get clients through online. And so I'm doing a lot of document exchange back and forth, and I have to deal with documents and things like that. And PDF Pen is absolutely critical for that workflow for me. It allows you to create and edit PDFs, so you can actually get in there and edit text. I think it is the best PDF editor out there for the money. It's less expensive and has more features than a lot of the other PDF applications that are out there on the market. I use it for marking up PDF documents. So going back and forth with ideas, I can draw on top of PDFs. I can put circle things and lines and arrows and stuff like that, make notations, send that back and forth. It's also used for filling out PDF forms, which is really great. And probably one of the killer features for me is adding my signatures electronically, so I don't have to do the type of thing where I print out stuff. It's gotten to the point so much that occasionally I have to fax something and I just groan because I'd prefer to just put it in PDF Pen, throw my signature on it, fill out the form, and send it back to them as a PDF. And it's just really convenient and easy. And one really nice thing it has, if you're doing a lot of markup, they have a library. If you go under the Windows menu in PDF Pen or just hit Command Y, there's a little library and you can save common elements and things that you use in your PDF documents right within the library, and then you just drag them out. And it even comes with a whole host of proofreader marks. So if you're an educator or a teacher or an editor, somebody like that, they have these really nice hand-drawn proofreader marks that you can just drop right on top of your documents, save out the PDF, and throw it right back. They're hand-drawn with transparency and they look great. So really great product. Absolutely love it. They have free trials available on their website if you want to check it out. So you can just go to smilesoftware.com. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the MacCast. So let's talk about some of the new products Apple has released recently. As was kind of rumored, there are new MacBook Airs that came out. Four new models, two 11-inch models and two 13-inch models. The 11-inch models offer the same 5-hour battery life, but have been significantly upgraded to the Sandy Bridge architecture. The 999 model, which is the lowest-end model, comes with a 1.6 gigahertz dual-core Intel Core i5 processor, 2 gigs of memory, and a 6 gigabyte flash SSD drive, also using the Intel HD graphics, the HD graphics 3000 across the board on all these models. Then the next 11-inch model is $1,199 US, same 1.6 gigahertz dual-core Intel Core i5 processor, 4 gigs of memory on that one, and they double the SSD storage to 128 gigabytes. And then on the 13-inch models, they have the 7-hour battery life, so a little bit larger battery is going to give you a little longer performance. They come with a 1.7 gigahertz dual core Intel Core i5 processor, 4 gigabytes of memory across the board. The 1299 model is 128 gigabyte flash drive, flash SSD drive, and then the 1599 model, which is the top of the line model, is doubles that SSD storage to 256 gigabytes. All of the models have two USB 2.0 ports, and they added the Thunderbolts. I think that's going to be a common theme you're going to see as Apple releases its new products. Everything is going to have the Thunderbolt port added in. And then on the 13-inch model, they also have an SD card slot. There's a little more room. Apple can get some stuff in there. As far as performance on the new models go, MacNN did some Geekbench benchmark tests on them. And just with a pure benchmark test, the 1.7 gigahertz Core i5 13-inch MacBook Air actually outscored the 2.4 gigahertz Core i5 MacBook Pro from just a couple years ago. So that's a significant jump up in performance. And there's also some good news if you're a do-it-yourselfer. There were rumors leading up to the announcement that Apple might be actually soldering the flash memory right onto the motherboard, so you wouldn't be able to swap out your SSD drive. That turned out to not be the case. iFixit and those folks did the teardown. There still is a connector there, so you can actually drop in your own SSD. So if you want to go with a lower flash storage, you can do that and then add your own later. But early reports are that this model is still hot. It's selling really, really well. We even had some indications this week that some retail stores were possibly selling out, although Apple was still showing 24-hour ship times on their online store. So I think there's still pretty good availability if you want to pick one up, but they're going fast. And not surprising given the performance jump and the fact that Apple added in the Thunderbolt, which is going to be significant, I think, especially in a model like the MacBook Air, because that's going to give you longevity and expandability. You can do a lot with that Thunderbolt port, just that single port that's on that model. So Apple's going to really be able to leverage that, and you're going to be able to leverage that if you pick up one of these systems. The other system that got an update was the Mac Mini. That was also expected. The Mac Mini now comes in three configurations, two standard configurations and one server configuration. They were able to drop the price about $100, so the starting model is $599. That's with a 2.3 gigahertz Core i5 processor, 2 gigs of RAM, a 500 gigabyte hard drive, and the Intel HD Graphics 3000, the integrated Intel graphics. The next model up, the 799 model, is a 2.5 gigahertz Core i5 processor with 4 gigs of RAM, 500 gigabyte hard drive, and that one has the discrete AMD HD Radeon HD 6630 graphics. And then the server model is now a 2.0 gigahertz quad-core Intel Core i7, 4 gigs of RAM, the dual 500 gigabyte hard drives. Those are 7200 RPM drives, and then it has the Intel HD Graphics 3000, so the integrated graphics. And then all of the new Mac Mini models have Thunderbolt, Mini Display Port, still the HDMI, FireWire 800, and four USB 2.0 ports, and the SDXC SD card slot. So lots of connectivity options on that model, including the bump up to Thunderbolt. You may or may not have noticed there that I didn't mention they have them having an optical drive. There is no SuperDrive in this model, so I think Apple's really signaling that they're going to be relying less and less on the SuperDrive. So no CD or DVD drive built in. It does support the CD-DVD sharing, just like on the MacBook Air. And it also supports Apple's AirPort MacBook Air SuperDrive. So the external USB SuperDrive that you can get for your MacBook Air will also work on the new Mac Minis. As far as performance goes, these are another significant jump up. I mean, that Sandy Bridge architecture is pretty smoking in terms of performance. So compared to the old Mini, you can probably expect at least a 30% jump in performance, maybe even more for some operations. iFixit also did point out that if you get the single hard drive model, there's an empty hard drive cable port in there that is pretty easy to get to. The trick there is that with those drives, you need a special serial ATA hard drive adapter to actually connect that thing up. So it's not going to be really, you're not going to be able to just take an off-the-shelf hard drive and put it in there, but hopefully some third-party vendors or companies will come up with some solutions for adding another drive, a second drive to a Mac Mini. And that could be a standard you know, spindle hard drive, spinning hard drive, or potentially an SSD drive that you could pop in there. So you really could ramp up the storage on your Mac Mini. Again, between that and the Thunderbolt, that's going to give you a lot of expandability and future-proofing. So some exciting new Mac models from Apple. Also, they threw out, and this is a pre-order, a new display. They're going to be replacing the Apple LED Cinema display with a new 27-inch, what they're calling the Thunderbolt display. So it's no longer the LED Cinema display, just simply the Thunderbolt display. It's going to sell for $999 US. It is a 27-inch LED backlit display. It has a 16:9 aspect ratio. The native resolution is 2560x1440. And it uses the in-plane switching technology, so it has a pretty good viewing angle, 178 degrees on the viewing angle. I imagine it's going to look gorgeous, just like all of Apple's displays do. The cool thing is that it gives you a single cable that splits out into a Thunderbolt connector and a MagSafe connector, just like the old LED Cinema display, although now instead of mini display port, you have Thunderbolt, which means it's going to be a perfect hub, a perfect docking station for your MacBook Air, your MacBook Pro, and you'll be able to just connect that right in. It does have three USB ports on the back, one FireWire 800 port and a Thunderbolt port, and even a gigabit Ethernet port. So you'll be able to hook all your cables into the back of the display and just have that one single cable that goes out to your desktop. So lots of expandability built right into the display. I'm really considering getting one of these. I'm at least lusting after it. I don't know if I can afford the price tag, but I really do want one. Oh, and it also has the built-in FaceTime HD camera. I don't know if that's an upgrade from the prior display. I think it is. I think the HD cameras are new on the newer model Macs, and I think that's new to the Thunderbolt display. What having all those ports means, though, is that you can easily do things like daisy chain two displays together, so you could have two 27-inch displays. And I think that's just a graphics processor limit in the current model Macs. If you had a GPU that would support more displays, you probably could hook up additional ones, daisy chaining them together. Also, you can connect up to six Thunderbolt devices chained on that Thunderbolt port, so you can get a lot of expansion and still only have the one single cable going to your notebook. As for whether or not the new displays will support the older mini DisplayPort Macs, it's looking from Apple's website like they won't, although it's really not clear. I've been getting mixed reports from different sites and things like that I've been trying to run down. Interestingly, Apple still seems to be selling the LED Cinema display, the 27-inch, on their website for the same price, $999 US, and it still shows a 24-hour ship time. That may be because the Thunderbolt display is a pre-order right now and does not ship, and, well, Apple's saying within the next 60 days it'll ship, sometime within the next 60 days. So who knows if that'll be next month or September. It could be up to 60 days away. But if you're in the market for a new display and you have a Thunderbolt connector, this is a really nice option from Apple. Something else interesting related to displays that came out this week is macOS 10 Lion apparently has some kind of display mode called a high DPI mode. It was discovered because it can be enabled via the developer tools that Apple has released recently, I think Xcode 4.2, and it shows that Apple might be preparing for higher resolution independent displays. There's a dilemma that's going on. If you want to increase the pixel density, get to the mythical Retina display resolutions or pixel densities on a display, say like a 30-inch display, you're going to be cramming a lot of pixels in there. And if you have the standard resolution graphics that are in the OS right now, you're going to have tiny little icons and tiny little text. It's going to be very, very hard to read. So Apple's been experimenting and playing around with resolution independence and how they're going to achieve that. I guess this high DPI technology is something that could enable that. What it does is it enables new display modes that basically let you see these high DPI options. So you flip the switch in the developer tools, you can see these new display options. And essentially what they do is give you effective resolutions. Well, right now the testing tools give you effective resolutions of 720x450 pixels on a 1440x900 display. So basically everything looks like it's zoomed in, like you did the whole display zooming thing, but rather than being blurry, it's absolutely crisp because it's actually rendering that resolution at 1440, so doubling the pixels. And that's the idea here. Right now they're doing testing, but you can imagine there's a 5120 by 3200 pixel 30-inch display. So you got a lot of pixels there. At the native resolution, everything would be really small, but if you do 2560 by 1600 high DPI resolution, so effectively what looks like on the screen is the same resolution as today's current 30-inch display, you've got, what is that, double or quadruple the pixels? I got to get better at my math. But you're going to have a really high pixel density and not end up with tiny little images and stuff like that. So that's going to make that doable. And it looks like they're throwing this into the developer tools so developers can play around with that. And then they can throw in and start to integrate in higher resolution assets and graphics and stuff like that for their programs. And Apple seems to be sticking with this whole 2x the display thing to allow for scaling and some sort of transition with the technology. At least that's what it's looking like right now. And hopefully I've understood how that technology works. It gets a little confusing when you start delving into 4x and 2x and how this is all going to work. You kind of have to see it. I think Ars Technica had some images up on their website describing this technology if you want to take a look at those. But that's what's been going on with Apple's new hardware. Now we probably should get into some software stuff and mainly into Lion. I think the rest of the show is going to be devoted to Lion. I'm going to give you some of my installation experiences, some tips on doing installs, and then some of my first impressions along with a bunch of other tips and tricks for different areas. And I welcome you, if you've discovered a cool tip or a trick or something that you've run across that I don't cover on the show, please send me an email, shoot me an audio comment, something like that. Let me know the tip or the trick, because I want to share as many of these as possible. We're all now in this transition phase of moving from Snow Leopard into Lion, and it's good to know those little hidden gems and tricks and stuff like that are in there. So we're going to be trying to do a lot of those on future episodes of the MacCast. But if you are getting ready to upgrade, maybe you haven't upgraded yet, you really are going to want to prepare your current system, your Snow Leopard system, and get ready for the upgrade. The main reason is because it is a straight upgrade on top of Snow Leopard. You can do a clean install, and there's more and more tricks for doing that. I'm going to cover those, a few of those in a second. But let's just say you were going to do the standard over-the-top upgrade and you want to prep your system. Some things that I would recommend you do is, one, archive and clean out all your old files and data. Like, get your system, do some house cleaning, get all of that stuff cleaned up, and don't bring along a lot of excess baggage. We can all build up junk in the crevices of our system and our hard drives and stuff like that over years of use, and you want to clean that stuff out. I heard somebody told me a story that they've been on people's systems and they still have stuff that, you know, came over from OS System 9 and they're running Snow Leopard. There's like resource files and stuff like that hanging around in the deep, dark recesses because they've just done upgrade after upgrade after upgrade, which is perfectly fine, but get all that stuff off there. If you have old data and files and stuff like that you really don't need anymore, get that stuff off your hard drive. You are going to need a little extra breathing room to do the install because Apple does create this emergency boot partition and you have to still download the installer and then it has to get run. So you need some space to be able to do the update. So clean all that stuff off, move it off to archives, put it on external drives and maybe do some DVD burns of those old photos and stuff like that. Get all of that stuff out of there. And then run your software update and make sure your current Snow Leopard is completely up to date. You're up to date on all your Apple application updates and your third-party application updates. In the last couple of weeks, a lot of developers have updated their software to support Lion. So that way, when you transition over and you go to run your favorite application, you're not, one, going to have to go through an upgrade process, or worse, you're not going to have it crash on you and then have to go manually find an upgrade and get up to date on that. And then Apple also did just release a supplemental update to 10.6.8 that adds some fixes, most significantly some fixes to address issues in migrating your data through the migration assistant when you upgrade from Snow Leopard to Lion. So you're going to want to make sure that's in place so that you don't have any trouble bringing your user accounts and your data and your library files over to your new system. So make sure you do that. So get all your software, everything up to date, do the house cleaning, and then you probably want to just do some general maintenance. Run Disk Utility, probably boot from your original disk, run disk utility, and do repair permissions. Check your drive. Make sure your hard drive's in a good, healthy state. You're not getting any weird errors and warnings, because nothing is worse than being in the middle of the install and then your hard drive, something happens with it. It fails or dies or has a hiccup, and then you can't boot into anything, and you go immediately into panic mode. So make sure your hard drive is good and ready to go. And then any other general housekeeping you like to do. I like to clear out my system caches and font caches. Use a utility like Onyx or Cocktail is my favorite one to use. And just do all that house cleaning stuff. Get a good system, good running, healthy running system before you do your update. And then at that point, backup. And then backup again. In my case, I had three backups. I had my Time Machine backup. I had my standard super duper backup. And then after I did all my house cleaning and got my system ready, I pulled a third backup. And you do want to have at least two. Well, I guess now that you're doing the over-the-top installation, maybe that's not as important. But I like to have at least two backups, because if something goes wrong and you need to erase your internal hard drive and kind of start over, the minute you do that, if you only have one backup, then you don't have a backup. You just have a blank drive and one copy of all your data. You always want to have two copies of your data at any given time, and preferably three to be really safe. I also, I guess, had a fourth because I have a cloud backup with CrashPlant. So I have all my data also up in the cloud, my important files at least and stuff like that. So make sure you have all your backups. And then once you've done all that, you're pretty set. You're good to go. You can go ahead and launch the Mac App Store. You have to right now buy Lion from the Mac App Store. You make your purchase. It'll automatically download and then automatically start the installer. And you can go ahead and install unless you want to create an emergency boot disk that is other than the one that Apple creates during the install process, which is actually just a separate partition. So if you want the installer still around to maybe install on other systems, you're going to sneaker net it over and install on some of your other Macs, which you can do. There, all the licensing for Lion is now family licensing. You can put it on, I think, I have to remember if it's 5 or 10. I think it's up to 10 Macs, and most of us don't have that many. So you'll be able to install it all on all your Macs. But if you don't want to have to re-download the 3 or 4 gigabyte file on every machine, after it downloads on your first system and it launches the installer, go ahead and quit the installer. You can come back and relaunch it. It'll keep it in your dock. Quit the installer and then go make a backup copy of the OS X Lion installer.app, I think it's called. Backup that file. And that comes in handy too if you're going to want to build an emergency boot DVD or USB drive, which I'll walk you through in a minute. So make sure you back that up, then launch the application, run it, and it'll do its thing. I mean, it works pretty seamlessly. It creates, I think, first that emergency boot partition, then reboots into it, and then automatically runs the installer. And then you should be back up and running within probably 20-30 minutes, depending on how fast your system is. Now, clean install. If you do want to do a clean install, you do have a couple different options. I actually did a clean install on my system. I provided all of the details, intricate details, on the latest MacCast members show. So if you want to become a MacCast member and listen to that, you can hear that. But in essence, I'll give you the rundown. I decided to do a clean install of Snow Leopard, a complete clean install. I did a, you know, a lot of people call it a nuke and pave. Essentially, I didn't even use Migration Assistant to bring over any of my stuff. I brought everything over by hand. So every folder, every document in my home folder, I wanted to leave the entire library folder in my home folder behind. I did not want to bring that over. So I did a manual rather than doing Migration Assistant, because within Migration Assistant, you have to kind of just bring over your whole user account. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted only specific files. So I brought over my music folder, my photos, my movies, all those little individual folders, with the exception of the library folder, and then nothing else. Within the library folder, there were some significant things, preferences for specific applications that are in the library preferences folder, and then also application support files for some critical applications that I wanted to bring over that are in your library application support folder. And then the only other thing was the mail folders within the library, which has all of your mail data and your mail attachments and stuff like that. So those are the things that I brought over from the library folder, but nothing else. And again, I manually copied all that stuff over. So the way I did it, rebooted from the original Snow Leopard DVD that came with my system, ran the disk utility, formatted and partitioned my hard drive, then installed Snow Leopard. Then after I booted into Snow Leopard, I did all of my setup. I ran all of my software updates to get all of my operating system software up to 10.6.8. Then I installed the Apple applications that I use, which is iLife and iWork. Latest versions of those, ran software updates on those to get all of Apple's updates, and then I proceeded to reinstall just the third-party applications that I was going to use and rely on. So I installed all those and then ran the updates for those to make sure all of those were up to date. So now I had a clean system with all of my applications, all of my data, and then I did the OS X Lion upgrade over top of my system. So that's one clean install option. I'm not saying it's the best option. It's the one I chose to use, and it worked for me. It's worked out really well. My system's running really, really great. Now, another way you could do it, many people have pointed out, is you could purchase Lion, install Lion, and because it creates that emergency boot partition, once that's set up, you could reboot into the emergency boot partition, and all you have to do is hold down Command and R. When you're rebooting, it'll reboot into that partition, and it throws you right into the utilities, and then you could, at that point, format your drive, reinstall the operating system, and then run the migration assistant. After it reboots, it's going to ask you if you want to bring your data over. You could bring that back from a clone backup or a Time Machine backup. So I guess before you do that, what you may want to do, I guess you could use your Snow Leopard backups, but you could also do Lion, then create a backup, a clone backup with Carbon Copy Clone or a Super Duper or something like that of the Lion, the upgraded Lion system, and then have all of that migrated over. I'm not sure which process would be better. I don't think it would really matter either way, especially if you installed that latest update. You should be able to pull your data from Snow Leopard to Lion just fine. The last option would be, after you do that download, you can create an emergency boot disk, a DVD, or in my case, I just used an 8 gigabyte USB flash drive. And so after you buy Lion, it downloads and installs. You've made that backup of the Lion installer. Here's how you go about making an emergency boot disk. So go to that install macOS10lion.app file, wherever you saved that to. And then you're going to controller right-click on that and choose the show package contents option. Then you're going to go into the contents folder, and there's a folder called shared support. You go in there and you'll see a file, an image file, a DMG file called installesd.dmg. You're going to want to copy that out of the installer application package, and then that's what you're going to use to create your boot disk. That's actually the thing that creates the emergency boot partition as well. So it's going to be an exact mirror copy of that. And to create that copy, you'll use disk utility. And I'm going to describe the process for doing a USB flash drive, but it's pretty similar to doing the DVD drive. Actually, doing a DVD is almost easier. So launch disk utility, and then you want to go ahead and format your USB drive using the format tab. And you want to make sure that you've set the partition mapping to GUID, and then create the partition, and then format your drive using macOS 10 extended journaled format. And then that way you'll have your drive ready to go to burn the image onto. And then once that's done, you'll select your drive, go into the Restore tab, and you'll see two fields there, a source and a destination. You want to drag the install esd.dmg into the source area. So that'll be your source. And then drag your USB flash drive into the destination field. And those should be in the list on the left. If not, you can also drag them in from the finder. And then just click the restore button. And then in probably 15 minutes or so, it will create that, it'll burn that image or image that image, DMG file, onto the flash drive. And then you'll have a bootable flash drive that you can run a Lion installer from. So that would be a good way, if you need to sneakernet that installation over to a bunch of other systems, and plus at that point you'll have an emergency boot disk in case your internal hard drive completely fails. Because that's one of the concerns with Apple just creating an emergency boot partition is what if you have a total drive failure? How are you going to boot your system? Interestingly enough, on the newer systems, the MacBook Airs and the new Mac Minis that I was just telling you about, you can actually boot over the internet off of Apple servers, but only on those two systems. So Apple's obviously thinking about the situation where what happens if the internal hard drive fails? What are we going to do? They've created an option for that, but not for older systems. If you want to do the DVD, if you want to burn a DVD, it's even easier. You just go into choose the burn DVD option in Disk Utility, and then just select that install esd.dmg file and burn your DVD from that, and then you'll have an emergency boot DVD. If you don't want to go through all that hassle and you don't mind waiting and paying a little bit more money, Apple also did announce that they are going to be selling Lion on that cool little Apple branded USB key or USB stick through the Apple retail stores. But it's not going to be until August, and it's going to cost you $69 instead of $29, which is what you can get it through the App Store. And, of course, those are U.S. Prices. As I was saying earlier, you do need to have a fair amount of free disk space, so that's something also to know when you get ready to do your Lion install. You need 17 gigabytes of free disk space, and the reason for that is you need 4 gigabytes for the installer and then 13 gigabytes for OS X Lion itself. That's to create the emergency boot partition and install the operating system. So if your hard drive is really, really full, make sure you clean that off before you start any of this stuff. And that's pretty much how you upgrade to Lion. Those are your options. First impressions for me of Lion. Well, first and foremost, Apple sold a gazillion copies. Well, not a gazillion, but at least a million downloads on the first day. So that's not actually sales. It's important to point that out. I think I bet a lot of people, if you installed it on two or three systems and you didn't remember to make a backup of that installer the first time, you're gonna have to re-download it. But over a million people downloaded Lion on day one, so lots of people are upgrading. As far as after I ran the install, even with the clean installation, I was expecting things to be faster. Almost every Mac OS X operating system, every time I've upgraded, even on my current system, seems to get a little bit of a speed bump. I will say that Lion is not slow. I don't notice in normal operations and tasks that it's any faster or slower than Snow Leopard. I would say my performance is about the same as it was before. It does feel really zippy, though, considering all of the UI stuff that's going on. There's a lot of graphic stuff going on in terms of animations, a lot of core animation in there. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I'm still kind of jury out on that in terms of specific areas where they've implemented animations, but it definitely doesn't feel slow. It doesn't feel like a huge, you know, like I have a whole brand new machine. And I would have expected that, especially doing the clean install that I did, that there'd be a little bit of a performance jump, maybe 10-15%, something like that. But I'm really not seeing that. My immediate reaction after rebooting was that it didn't feel like a major upgrade. It is a major upgrade under the hood, but you have to kind of look closely to see the changes, at least at first. They kind of creep up on you. There's a lot of subtle changes and tweaks that I think add up to be a lot. But what was kind of nice about that was I was able to jump in and just really start using my system right away. It might have been the fact that I did some research. I kind of knew what to expect and where to find some of the new features. But if you just wanted to use it the same way you were using Snow Leopard, you could. And there's not anything upfront and in your face significant about the changes. We're going to talk about some of the subtle changes, and they do become significant once you start discovering them, and that could be a problem for some users. I think new users coming to the Mac, this is probably the most user-friendly version of the operating system that Apple's ever put out. For power users, I think some of us are having a little bit of a harder time because some things are hidden, some things have changed that we're kind of used to. But it definitely did feel natural, even using all the new gesture methods for sort of navigating around the operating system. The one huge upfront change that Apple does warn you about is the changes to the scrolling and the missing scroll bars that are turned off by default. They actually pop up a window right after you install Lion to explain those changes. And once again, I think that's more for people who have been using the operating system for a while. The new users are just going to think this is how the system actually already worked. So what are kind of some of my favorite things about the new operating system? Well, the new mail application, I absolutely love the conversations feature. This is the thing that allows you to group your conversations together. There's one important setting for me that's not turned on by default that makes it really useful, and that's the ability to group your sent messages along with other messages that are in your conversation. You actually have to go into the settings and turn that on, but I recommend turning that on if you want to use the conversations feature. It hides all of the quoting, so when you're doing a back and forth reply with somebody, hides all that quoting, and you just get the new parts of the message. You can still expand out all of the quoted text, but to have it hidden just really cleans up the mail, you know, that third pane in the mail. And it's also a reorientation of the layout, so you have three columns more like you would on iOS. Some people don't like that. Apple does give you the ability to go back and, once again, in the mail settings, go back to what they call the classic mode of mail. So you can turn that off and get back into the old way of doing things if that's what you prefer. Another thing I'm really enjoying about the new operating system, although this is getting mixed reviews, is the universal dictionary and auto correction. I'm not a very good speller. I'll admit that to you right now. And I do like the autocorrect. And what's really nice is within the operating system, you know how when you misspell a word, it'll red underline it in Snow Leopard? Well, now when it does an autocorrection, it will show you a blue underline under the words that it autocorrected. So if it's autocorrected something that you didn't want autocorrected, it jumps out at you and you can go back and fix it. The other nice thing is just like in iOS, it does pop down that little hint of what it is going to autocorrect to. And if you don't want to accept that, you can just hit escape and it'll automatically accept whatever you're typing in. And that was something I always struggle with on iOS, is that I'm on my keyboard on the iOS and I don't want to have to jump up and click that little Xbox. I wish there was a keyboard way to dismiss that, and there is an OS X Lion, so I really appreciate that feature, being able to dismiss that. Another feature that I'm getting familiar with and starting to like more and more is versions and autosave. It's really shocking at first, because applications that have autosave and versions enabled don't have your traditional file save and save as options. And that's a little disconcerting if you've been using the operating system for a long time and you're used to those things being there. But just like on iOS, autosave is always saving your document in the background, so you don't have to worry about saving. If you do a Command S, it will actually save a version. It's in essence creates a save point for that document, and it's just saving the differences, so it's not going to use up a lot of hard disk space, or at least that's what Apple says, and I haven't noticed it actually eating up a lot more storage space in the applications that I have that have versions and autosave enabled. And developers do need to enable that in their applications, so not every application out of the box in OS X Lion has that feature, but I have a feeling the applications where it makes sense, a lot of developers are going to adopt this really quickly, because it is a really cool feature. To get into your versions, what happens is if you save different versions, or if it autosaves those versions and you want to go back and maybe look at one, or how often is it that you're working on a document, you accidentally did a save as and you didn't mean to save over something and now it's lost. Well, now with versions, you can go back. You just go up to the title in the menu bar right at the top of your document, and you'll see this little down triangle. You click on that and you have new options to go in and browse the saved versions. And then it kind of enters this time machine mode with your current document on the left and all the versions of your document on the right. And you can go back through time to the different save points, to the different versions that it saved. And you can actually pull the whole document back. Or what's really nice is you can even copy and paste from an old version into a new version. So if it was just one paragraph that you needed to go back and grab something that you wrote, maybe deleted, and now you've changed your mind, you want to go back and get it, you can go back and get that through the versions. It is so cool. I'm really liking that feature, and I think it's going to be more and more handy for me. As far as what happens with the save as, because you don't have save as anymore, it's constantly saving in the background, what you get is duplicate. And so you do file duplicate, and it creates a new copy of your document right there in place, adds underscore copy to the file name until you go to save it. And then when you do a save, a Command S, and that's the only point where you see the save menu. Once you've created a duplicate, when you're working on a duplicate document and you haven't saved it yet, you do get a save option in the file menu. So you save it, it'll allow you to tell the system where you want to save that document. And then from that point forward, it's in the autosave mode and in the versioning mode. One little bit of inconsistency that I did notice, I have one application where there's actually a duplicate option in the edit menu. I think a lot of text editors and a lot of documents have duplicate in the edit menu. So I now have file duplicate and edit duplicate, which I think could be confusing to some new users. Like, what's the difference between the duplicate in the edit menu and the duplicate in the file menu? So Apple's going to have to address that at some point, or developers are going to probably have to address that at some point. I don't know what a different term would be, but maybe copy or clone or something like that. I have no idea. The other option that's in there is something called the lock option, which will lock a document from changes. I think that actually happens naturally after about 14 days of after saving a document. If you don't edit it or touch it for 14 days, it goes into a lock mode. And I think that's a little safety mechanism. So the next time you open that document, it'll warn you it's in locked mode and ask you if you want to reopen it for editing. It's a really easy process. You just say yes, and then you can start editing away on the document again. But I think that's related to some of the versioning stuff. I'll have to learn a little bit more about that lock feature. A number of people, there had been some debate on whether or not you need to have Time Machine enabled for the versions feature to work. I think it's pretty much been confirmed that you don't have to have Time Machine turned on. A lot of people thought it might work through that technology because it's so visually similar when you're looking at the versions, but you don't need to have that turned on. And then about my only complaint so far is that the side-by-side view when you're in the version mode doesn't seem to be resizable. So I've had some applications, most notably Omni Outliner, where it scales down the document real narrow and it's hard to see the text between the two documents. And because you can't resize it in versions, there's really nothing you can do about it. So I'm hoping that's just a developer thing, or that's something that can be changed or adjusted at some point in the future, but really loving the new versions. There's a couple features that I'm calling the meh features, the things that I'm kind of indifferent on. One that's getting a lot of buzz and press is the new natural scrolling. That means that by default, when you're doing the two-finger scrolling on the trackpad, or using your scroll wheel on your mouse, or the one-finger scrolling on the Magic Mouse, the direction is now reversed. You can actually turn it off in the mouse or the trackpad settings. So if you don't like it, you can go turn it off. I'm sticking with it. It's not bothering me so much, and I've actually almost completely transitioned. As a matter of fact, today I went to use my wife's system, which hasn't been upgraded, and she has a Magic Trackpad, and I went the wrong direction, or I guess the right direction if you're in Lion, but I tried to do it the new way instead of the old way, and I've only been using Lion for about a week, so I'm already transitioning over, and I think I do like the new method a lot better. If you know, if you want to go down in your document, you push the text up. And that's what Apple is calling the natural scrolling. If you haven't upgraded to Lion yet and you want to try and start training yourself now and get used to the new method, there is an application called Scroll Reverser from Pilot Moon, and you can install that under Snow Leopard, and then that gives you an option to do the reverse scrolling in the current operating system, or in the old operating system, I guess that's the word, depending on which system you're on. As has probably been mentioned a lot, you may have heard a lot already, OS X Lion really ups the level of gestures and usability of trackpads. Apple really seems to be moving in that direction, maybe moving away from the mouse. I use a Magic Mouse on my desktop, and one thing I'm not so thrilled about is there is some inconsistency in how the gestures work between the trackpad and the mouse. And I completely get why. It's really hard to do a three-finger gesture on a Magic Mouse. So almost all the time what I've discovered is that, or almost with complete consistency what I've discovered is that a three-finger gesture on the trackpad ends up being a two-finger gesture on the Magic Mouse. So I'll give you an example. To access the new mission control mode on the trackpad, you do a three-finger swipe up. On the Magic Mouse, you actually use two fingers and you do a two-finger tap. So moving between the two input devices is going to be a little bit confusing, almost to the point where it makes me feel like I need to go out and buy another Magic Trackpad. I think Apple really is saying the future is in trackpads and multi-touch, and I think they're going to be doing more and more of that kind of stuff. I think Apple's signaling the death of the mouse potentially. We'll have to see. But I know a lot of people still really like their mice, so we'll see how that goes. The other thing I've noticed with gestures is I sometimes accidentally trigger a gesture movement when I really don't mean to. And so a common one for that is now in Safari, you can do a double tap on the Magic Mouse, or I think it's a two-finger tap. I have to look it up now. I don't know what the gesture is on the trackpad. I have been using my Magic Mouse almost exclusively, but you can do the Safari zoom in thing like you do on iOS devices, and I think it's a two-finger double tap on the Magic trackpad and a one-finger double tap on the Magic Mouse, and I do trigger that often by accident when I don't mean to, and so that's been a little bit frustrating or annoying. But again, that's probably just learning the gestures and getting more familiar with the new operating system. Another feature that Apple really touts is the fact that it can remember the windows that are open in an application. So if you're in Safari and you have a bunch of tabs open and then you quit Safari, the next time you launch Safari, it's going to reopen with all those tabs and those websites up. I really don't like that. I open lots of tabs when I'm browsing in Safari, and I like the fact that it can reset itself, or that did reset itself under Snow Leopard, and when I came back, I had a fresh, clean browser to work with. I could see how this could be advantageous in some applications, but I don't think for all of them. Luckily, there's a little trick. If you hold down the Option key when you're quitting an application, and you can see this in the if you go to the application menu and hold down the Option key, you'll notice that the quit option changes to a quit and discard Windows option. And that way it'll throw away and won't remember your position. The operating system itself, when you do a restart, also does the same thing. Everything that was open when you shut down or restart your system will by default come back up like that after you do a reboot. When you're doing a restart, there's actually a checkbox you'll notice in the dialog that pops up when it asks you if you want to restart. You can uncheck that, and then it will discard all those window positions and open applications and stuff like that. So they do give you the options. And the last kind of myth feature is one that I haven't been able to play around with. It's AirDrop, which it would be cool if I was in a work group, if I worked with other people. I'm not so certain how much I'm going to use it at home. It's basically zero configuration file sharing. There's a new AirDrop icon in the Finder, and when you press that, it'll go out and find any other Macs running Lion on your home network and gives you little drop points where you can drop files to share those files with those users. And I think on the receiving end, it pops up and says, so-and-so wants to share a file with you. Is that okay? And if you click okay, then that file is sent over to your system automatically. So very cool way to do some sharing. The one thing to note about that is it does require some newer hardware, or I guess I should say really newish hardware. Older Macs before late 2008, may or may not be able to support the feature. Basically, anything since late 2008 or later, there's certain kind of airport support or wireless support that you need to have built into your model and for the AirDrop feature to work. So just something to note if you're on one of those older systems and you're wondering why AirDrop isn't working for you or isn't showing up for you. Now, as far as the things that I'm not completely happy about, well, the loss of color visual cues in the Finder sidebar. So one of those things, memorize how I had said when you first launch the system, you don't notice a bunch of stuff right away, but then there's the little subtle changes. The Finder sidebar doesn't have any color on the icons anymore. A lot like they did to iTunes and some of the other applications, they're all just shades of gray. They don't have the custom icons. So one thing that I always relied on is I have a Maccast folder that had a custom icon in my favorites section of my Finder sidebar. That I was able to really quickly see and drop files to or go access to it. Now I actually have to read the text because it looks like every other folder that I have in the favorites section of my Finder sidebar. So I wish there was a way to turn that color back on. Interestingly, when you go to other menus like the Go menu and some of the other open save dialog box pop-up menus, the colors are still there. So I'm not sure why Apple doesn't give us the option to put it in the Finder sidebar, but that would be really nice. Another thing that I really don't like is that your hard drives are now down at the bottom of the window under the devices section. They move the whole devices section down to the bottom of the window. There doesn't seem to be any way to move that back up. So your favorites are up at the top, and Apple has this new section in the favorites called All My Files. I'm leaving that there for now, although I'm not finding it very useful. It basically has your most recently, I think, opened files or created files, all organized into different categories. So your images, your documents, mail, files, things like that, they're all in little category sections. And in the default view, it kind of uses a cover flow style method for moving back and forth between those documents. So images, PDFs, music, movies, those sorts of things are all kind of grouped together in that section. I don't think I'll be using that a lot. Luckily, you can go into your sidebar preferences and turn those things off if you don't like them. So there is a little bit of customization. I just wish that I could move my hard drives and stuff all the way back up to the top. Another thing that I'm not completely thrilled about is, again, the use of all that core animation stuff. I do think it's a little bit overdone. There's been some tutorials and hacks out there for just doing some simple terminal preference hacks for turning some of that stuff off. I may go in and do that at some point. I'm sticking with it for now. Maybe I'll warm up to it or get a little bit more used to it. But if it starts to become really old or annoying after a while, I think I will get rid of it. My main frustration with that is I think a lot of it is just to do animation. I don't think it really reinforces or improves the user experience or the usability of the application. It's more like, hey, look what we can do. We can fly this thing all over the place. And I understand if there's a specific user interface reinforcement of something, or if it makes sense to have an animation to add to the user experience. But when it's just doing it because you can do it and you have a really fast GPU, I don't know. I'm really not thrilled about that. The other thing I mentioned, I really love the conversations view in Mail, and I like the new three-panel, three-column viewing of Mail. The one thing I'm not sure that I like about it is that you can't turn off the main Mail pane where you read your mail. And what I worry about there is a lot of spammers rely on you opening mail or little things in your mail to kind of do tracking. I know that's based on images, and I have the images turned off, but even sometimes when I click on something, the images come up anyway, even though I have the setting to not have it display images. And I just really prefer to not have that stuff come up. I worry about it on iOS too, even when like deleting a group of emails, when you go into the edit mode, it brings up those little previews of them. And I'm wondering if that counts against the, you know, you've opened this email account and now I've verified your email address and I know that it's legitimate and I'm going to spam you again kind of thing. So a little bit worried about that. But as I mentioned earlier, you can go into the classic layout and go back to the old method where you can actually hide that pane. I just wish there was a way to hide the pane temporarily in the new view. There have been some reports of some people having issues, although most people I'm talking to who are running Lion have been running it very successfully. There seems to be very, very few or very minor issues, very few people impacted by the upgrade. So if you've been worried, is it a stable upgrade? So far, it's been stable for me. Again, I did a lot of my due diligence, though, and made sure that the critical third-party applications that I use were already updated and ready to support Lion. And I think that's really important. Make sure that the applications you use on a daily basis and the hardware, don't forget about your peripherals, the hardware that you rely on has updated drivers and has full Lion support. I know some people got into trouble because I think Drobos weren't fully supporting Lion on release day, although they just pushed out an update for the Drobo systems. One that I kind of knew might get impacted for me is my FireWire audio interface. That's not supported in Lion. I've had to go to a backup system and use something different to get it working. But I was kind of prepared for that, so I knew that going in. As far as some of the other hardware issues or things that we've been hearing, there were some reports early on of some Wi-Fi connectivity issues for some people after upgrading. Luckily, it sounds like it's a pretty simple fix. You might just have to reset your network devices, so turn off AirPort in your Mac and turn it back on, maybe reboot your system after doing the upgrade, or in the more extreme cases, go in and reset your modem and your router and stuff like that, and then reboot your Mac and restart your AirPort. And most of the time, that's going to get you back up and running. We've also had some reports of some iMac models freezing when viewing video. It doesn't seem to matter whether it's QuickTime or Flash. The reports that have been showing up online say it's pretty easily repeatable. So if you have the issue, you're probably going to know that you have it. Hopefully Apple will issue a fix for that relatively quickly, hopefully in the next OS update for Lion. It's already, I think, been rumored that there's a 10.7.2 update seeded out to developers. So Apple probably is aware of some bugs that are already sitting out there. But it, again, seems really light on the bugs. Most stuff just seems to work. And then not all third-party network-attached storage backup solutions seem to be working with Lion, especially with Time Machine. I've always recommended that if you're going to do Time Machine over a network and that's really important to you, that you just go with a time capsule. I know third-party solutions are out there that support and say they support Time Machine, but everybody I've known who has one, some people say it works great. Other people say I've had nothing but problems, and now with this upgrade, you're seeing that vendors are going to have to update their firmware and make some changes. So that's something that impacts people. And if that's your critical backup, you don't want that messed with. So if you are relying on third-party backup solutions, check with your vendor. See if they have an update for Lion before you do your upgrade. That would be my advice to you. So that's my impressions of Lion and sort of how the upgrade process went. The only other news item I have for you today is something related to iMacs. Apple did come out and say that some of the new iMacs, the ones sold between May and July of 2011, they have identified have defective hard drives. Again, Apple's saying just some models. Actually, they even say something like an extremely small number of models, but they are replacing their 1 terabyte Seagate drives. So if you have a model that was manufactured between May and July of 2011, an iMac, you might want to bring it into Apple or contact AppleCare through the phone and see if you're in the list for a replacement hard drive, and make sure you're doing your backups. So in case something goes wrong before you can get that replaced, that you are covered. But that's it for the news for this week. Now I want to get to a bunch of Lion tips and tricks that I have come across since doing my upgrade. One of them is a really welcome change to Lion, and that is the ability to actually do a copy and merge in the Finder to not have to actually replace files or folders that have the same name. We're all used to dragging a file from one folder to another, and if it has the same name, it pops up the dialog box and says, do you want to replace? Well, what happens if you just want to keep both? Well, now in Lion, it'll pop up a dialog and it'll say, do you want to replace or do you want to keep both? And you can say keep both, and it'll just rename the new copy that you're copying in and add, I think, a 2 to the file name, or just a sequential numbering to the file name. If you actually move a folder with the same name, it'll do a little analysis and it'll prompt you, if you try and copy or move a folder with the same name, it'll prompt you if you want to replace it. If you copy a folder and you hold down the option key while dragging and it has the same name and it has files in it with the same names, it'll offer to merge the two, keeping the newer files, or you can replace the entire folder and replace all the files. So it gives you a couple of different options. When dragging multiple items from the Finder 2, a nice little thing that Lion does is it gives you a little number, a little status number to show you how many files that you're moving around. A lot like iPhoto. If you're familiar with dragging a sequence of photos from iPhoto to your desktop, you get that little number that indicates the number of files that you're moving around. That is now in Lion when you're copying files around. Now in Lion, Apple has replaced Exposé. If you got really familiar with Exposé in Snow Leopard, and I loved Exposé, they've changed it to this thing called Mission Control, and that kind of brings together Exposé and Spaces and stuff like that and changes it in some significant ways. Spaces are completely redone, so if you're used to the old way of Spaces, forget about it. There's a whole new way of doing it. I actually like the new way because I never used Spaces, but I know some pro users or some real heavy Spaces users are a little bit upset about the changes. But one change that was significant to me and it threw me off a little bit that I wanted to point out was the feature where you can show all of the open documents within an application. Under Exposé, it would come up when you activated that mode, the show all open documents in an application. The one way I knew how to do that was you click and hold the application icon in the dock. I have mine set to a hotkey. In my case, it's F10, but I've remapped it. I know you can do some sort of key command with the Exposé key on your keyboard. But when you go into that view, what you would have is you'd have all of the open documents in the Exposé view at the top, and then that little line, and then underneath that, you would have any documents that you had minimized for that application that would come up there. Well, those still come up down there if you have them minimized, but I was doing this in an application where I knew I didn't have any minimized windows, and there was like 3 or 4 things down along the bottom. And what I realized now is Apple is also now showing you the recently opened documents within that application down in that area. And there's really no visual indicator to indicate whether it's a minimized document or if it's just a recently opened document from that application. So that's a little bit confusing to me, and you might see that and get a little bit thrown off. So I thought I'd point that out. Another significant change that we probably should talk a little bit about that Apple made to OS X Lion is with respect to dashboard. Dashboard is now no longer this thing that kind of pops up over the top of your desktop. Actually, the whole operating system, Mission Control, Spaces, Desktops, which is that's the new name for Spaces. So let's call them what they are in Lion. They're called Desktops. So your desktops, your full screen applications, and a dashboard are all in kind of a linear orientation, and dashboard is off to the left. So you do a swipe to the right, and then the dashboard sort of slides in from the left. And then if you want to get to your other desktops, you slide the other way, and your desktops and your full screen applications slide in. So you're doing this whole left to right swiping things, and things are, I call the operating system really swishy. It kind of swishes around, but you don't have this kind of quadrants anymore like you used to have in Spaces, and you don't have your dashboard flying in over top of everything. You just swipe off to the left. Well, turns out you can actually go back to the old method of the dashboard if you prefer it that way. So if you go into System Preferences under Mission Control, there's a little checkbox that says Show Dashboard as Space. Now, it's interesting there. I didn't really notice that before, but they call it the dashboard is in a space, but your desktops are now just called desktops, not Spaces. Maybe they're just additional desktops in Spaces. I don't know. We're going to have to get all this new terminology down, but we've got Mission Control and Spaces and desktops and Launchpad. Launchpad's the other thing that I should point out to you. Launchpad is a feature on your trackpad. There is a gesture for it. If you do take three fingers in your thumb and kind of pinch them together, so I guess you call it a three-finger pinch gesture, it will bring up the Launchpad, and that's a new way to launch your applications. So they all kind of come up like iOS's Springboard launcher with the applications icons, and you can swipe between them, and you can create folders just like you do in iOS. But if you're like me and on your desktop you use a keyboard and mouse, there's really no gesture for bringing up that interface. It actually, when you install Lion, it adds a Mission Control icon and a Launchpad icon in your dock. But I like to have my dock clean, so I pulled those out of there, and I wanted a way to assign a keyboard shortcut for Launchpad in case I want to use it. Interestingly enough, in a week, I don't think I've used Launchpad a single time. I still just have an application folder in my dock, and I use the stacks method. I prefer that. I think it's quick and easy. Actually, even faster than that, what I use most of the time is Spotlight. Command, spacebar, bring up the Spotlight window, start typing the name of the application and hit enter, and boom, it launches my app. And I've set it up so that applications are the very first thing that come up in my Spotlight search to make that happen. But if you want to use Launchpad and you want a quick, easy access to it and you don't have a trackpad, you can assign a keyboard shortcut. Real easy to do. Just go into your System Preferences under Keyboard, and then you'll see a section called Launchpad and Dock. Click on that, and you'll notice by default, Launchpad doesn't have a hotkey. You can just double-click the area where the hotkey should be. It's, like I said, blank. Double-click in that area. It'll make it editable, and then you can assign a hotkey. In my case, I used the F8 key. A couple of people have pointed out maybe using the F4 key, which in the past on some keyboards was the dashboard key, but now that you can get to dashboard by doing the swipe thing, you might not need to use that key anymore, so you can reassign that, and that's how you set that up. Another significant change you'll probably notice after a little while of using the operating system is that in the Finder, there's no more little resize handle down in the lower right-hand corner of your windows. And that reason for that is because now windows can be resized from any edge, any corner. You can just grab over in that area, hover in that area. You'll notice your cursor change to the little double-ended arrow thing, and then you can pull that stuff around. Well, a couple cool tips that you can do now too is you can constrain that in a couple different ways. So if you want to resize from opposite edges at the same time, if you hold down the Option key while dragging an edge, it's going to resize from both edges. So the horizontal direction or the vertical direction, you can do that. You can also do it from the corners, resizing in both directions. And if you want to constrain it, so if you had a perfect square and you wanted to keep your orientation in a perfect square, just add a Shift key to that, So if you hold down option and shift and then resize, it'll kind of resize from almost like from the center, it feels like. So as you can tell, a lot of these changes are subtle, but really kind of significant when you start thinking about them, and especially when you take them in total. A lot of significant changes to how you interact and use the UI in the operating system. And another one that'll creep up on you, you might not notice immediately, is that in your home folder, there's no more library folder. Power users are used to using the library folder. That's where you go in, and if you have a problem, need to trash a preference file, a plist file, it's in your library folder. How do you get to it now? Well, it's hidden in Lion, but really just barely. It's not really hidden very, very deep. You can go in and find it. One easy way to do it is to go under the Go menu in the Finder and simply type /, and then library. Hit enter, and that'll bring up your library folder, at least temporarily. Another easier way is if you go under the Go menu and you just hold down the Option key while clicking on the Go menu, you'll see that the library folder is listed in there, and you can select it, and it'll pop up in the Finder, and you can get access to it that way. So if you need to get into that application support folder or something like that. I understand why Apple did this. The average user is not going to need to go into their library folder, or really shouldn't need to go in there. And by hiding it, it keeps some critical system files and user files safe. There's a lot of data in there that if you don't know what you're doing and you mess with something, you really could break the operating system to a certain degree. So Apple's just trying to protect us from ourselves, I think, in most cases. There have been some, again, terminal commands that you can find online now that you can run that'll turn that on permanently. So if you really want to have it back in your home folder, you can get that to come back. If you don't want to have to go through that kind of a hack, another thing you could do is once you have it up in the Finder using one of those other methods I just described, you could simply add it to the dock, you could put it up in the Finder toolbar, or you could put it in your sidebar. You can drag it over to your sidebar and have it there permanently. One change that I noticed, though, when I was testing this out, I put the library in my sidebar and then I wanted to get it out. I couldn't just drag it out and have it do the normal poof operation that it used to do. It seems like now you have to actually hold down the command key to drag items out of your sidebar to get rid of them. And I think that's actually a good change, because I've had instances where somebody accidentally drug something out of their Finder sidebar and then didn't know how to get it back. Interestingly enough, the way you get it back is you just go into your Finder preferences for the sidebar preferences, and check the default thing on that you removed from the sidebar, and you can get it back in there. So in case you're wondering how to do that. I already talked about conversations and mail, and a significant one for me to making it really useful was to make sure to include the sent messages. I didn't really tell you how to do that, so let me describe that process now. You go into your mail preferences and you click on the viewing tab, and then in the view conversations section, you'll see a little checkbox for include related messages. So you want to check that box on, and that'll enable you to get your conversations in mail. Once you have conversations enabled, I was using it for a while, and I suddenly noticed that I had specifically in my Gmail account some conversations that came up, and it said I had 3 duplicates of the same document, and I was a little bit concerned about that. And the reason why is it seems like Gmail, they handle IMAP folders a little bit differently. They call them labels on Gmail, and it actually creates copies in different sections. And I have a lot of those IMAP folders mapped into my mail account. And so what it was doing is it was picking up copies that were in other folders. And Gmail recently enabled something called, favorites are important. It's an important label, and it automatically labels a lot of your emails as important if you have that feature turned on in Gmail. I didn't even realize it was on until I saw these duplicates showing up. And so what you probably need to do, or what you want to do if you want to get rid of those, is go into your Gmail account and then turn off the show IMAP options. So if you do this, you go to the Gmail website in your browser, you go into the mail settings, and then go into the labels tab, and then you're going to want to uncheck the show in IMAP option for any IMAP folders you don't want to show up in macOS 10 mail for your Gmail accounts. And one significant one, like I mentioned, is probably turning off that important one. If you see those duplicates, it's a little blue link in the header area that says duplicates. That might be what's happening to you. So I wanted to point that out because it was a little bit confusing to me at first why I had all these duplicate emails. Now, here's a cool tip that I don't think has gotten a ton of press. I've seen this mentioned a couple places, but we've been hearing these rumors for a long time that Apple's been getting cozy with Nuance, the folks who make Dragon Naturally Speaking, that technology might be making its way further into the Mac and into iOS. Well, looks like in Lion there are a bunch of new voices, high-quality multinational voices that are supposedly from Nuance that you can turn on and enable. So we're all familiar with Bruce by now from Snow Leopard, a great voice in Mac OS X. Well, now you can get some international ones. And what's really cool about these is how they're enabled. They're not installed by default. They actually download and install over the internet when you want to enable them, and you can even preview them before you install them. So if you go into your system preferences under speech and then click on the text to speech tab and then click on or select customize from the system voice pull down menu, you'll see all of these new voices and you can run through them and select one. So they have British voices, they have Australian voices, they have German voices, Spanish voices. I mean, it's a huge list of multinational voices, and you can play previews of each one and then find one that you like and turn them on. I think I have a British English voice called Vanessa or something like that turned on in my system now. It sounds really nice. And that's a lot of fun to play around with. And they do really sound pretty natural, a lot like the Bruce voice. So play around with those. It's fun. Spotlight searching is changed a little bit in Lion. Again, one of these subtle changes. They've kind of exposed and made it easier to find and use search tokens. And I think we've talked about search tokens in the past. These are little like kind of keywords that you can filter your searches on. So a very common one is kind. Different kinds of files. This is great if maybe you just want to find an audio file or a specific image format like a JPEG or something like that. And so what you'll notice when you're using the standard Spotlight search window in the Finder, that's the one that you bring up in the full window when you do Command F in the Finder. As you're typing in the search area, you'll suddenly get this little drop down and it will give you hints for these little search tokens. And if you pick one of them, it'll pop up in a little bubble in the search bar and sort of constrain your search to that area. So name is one that comes up almost immediately. So where name contains a certain keyword, kind is another one. So an example, if you want to see this working, is start typing a term like MP3 or audio. And when you type that kind of keyword, it will show that search token. You can select it. It will add that to the Spotlight search area, and then you can complete whatever keyword you want to enter in there, and then it will constrain your search to that. So you can say MP3, put that token in place, and then I could type MacCast, and it's going to only show me the files that are MP3s for the MacCast. And it's a great way of doing filtering and kind of constraining your Spotlight searches, and it makes it easily accessible. Also, Boolean searches are fully supported in Spotlight search now. So if you've been looking for those, I think they were pretty much in Snow Leopard. I think they've gotten a little bit better in Lion. One change that some people aren't happy about, specifically people who use their Mac Minis as home theater systems, Front Row is gone. It is no longer in Lion, doesn't exist, isn't there, completely taken away. So if you've been using that and you rely on it for your home entertainment system, you may want to stick with Snow Leopard for a while. It turns out somebody figured out that you can bring over by hand a bunch of files from Snow Leopard, the files that support Front Row, and get them to work. I'll have the list in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to dive into this. I can't really promise how stable it is or how long it will continue to work. And as a matter of fact, as I was prepping for the show, I think an article came out that said the latest version of iTunes, the latest iTunes update, actually breaks compatibility with Front Row for iTunes or for iTunes stuff. So you'll no longer see your music in Front Row if you bring it over manually to Lion and then do the iTunes upgrade or have already done the iTunes upgrade. I would imagine also at some point if you apply a Lion update, it might blow away those Front Row files that you brought over. So I wouldn't depend on it, but in case you're wondering, you can kind of hack it in there and maybe get it working back again in Lion. Last little cool tip that I have for you, and then I have one more that came in from a listener, actually came about through some research from a question from a listener. But before we get to that, the last tip I have for you is a change in preview. There's some, again, subtle changes in preview, but one kind of significant one that's a lot of fun to play around with, and that is signatures, the ability to add a signature into your PDF documents using preview. And it's really clever the way Apple implemented this. So the way you get to it is you go to the view menu in an inside preview, and you go make sure that the show annotations toolbar is turned on. And then once you have the annotations toolbar on, you'll see a little icon. It looks like a little cursive S with an underline and an X, like where you would sign something. That's the signature menu. You click on that, and you can choose Create Signature from your built-in iSight. And it will give you instructions on screen as to what to do, but in essence, you sign a piece of white paper with black ink, and then you hold it up to the camera. Now, I noticed it was kind of tricky to see the camera when you're holding a piece of paper up in front of it, but off to the right of that window, it will show you it kind of in real time what the camera is seeing, the camera view. It'll even flip it around, and you can kind of get your signature lined up. There's a little blue line. You line it up on the blue line, and it's constantly capturing it. So if you pull the piece of paper away, you can see it'll kind of stick there. So you don't have to worry about not being able to see the camera. Kind of hold it up there, and it's pretty. It seems like it's pretty intelligent on picking up where the signature is on the piece of paper. Once it's looking right on the screen, then you hit OK, and it adds it into a little signature library. So the next time you click on that little signature icon from the toolbar, you'll see your signature right there, and it will insert it into your document with the transparency. You can resize it, move it into place, put it wherever you want, and it works remarkably well. The one thing that I'm wondering about is where that signature is stored and how securely it's stored. I think we're going to need to find out some information about that. I'm hoping that Apple really stores that in a secure fashion, but I'm not entirely positive. It does show, when you're looking at the signature, a little lock icon next to it. So I'm assuming that means it's in an encrypted file somewhere within your operating system so that you could only get to it if you were logged into your account and using preview. But I'm going to try and get some more details on the security of that whole feature. But still, a really cool feature, and it's built in right out of the box in preview in Lion. So play around with that. All right, as promised, I have a comment from Steven. He's a visually impaired Mac user and relies on some of the universal access features, and had a question about the new Windows zooming or Zoom desktop feature in Mac OS X Lion.
Hello, Adam. This is Steven in Houston, Texas. And I have a request. I really would like to get into the ears of Apple, because I know that there are many people at Apple that listen to your podcast, which is a great podcast, by the way, the MacCast podcast. Well, the problem is that many of us are visually impaired and use the desktop Zoom feature continuously in order to be able to access our Macs. Well, and I do really, truly appreciate this option. It is much better than on the Windows platform. But there are sometimes it doesn't work. Like in Command Tab, the screen stops panning, so I can't see the icons that are off screen that I'm trying to switch to. Also, in Time Machine, the desktop Zoom feature is not even available and is disabled while I'm in Time Machine mode, and it makes it difficult. Well, in Mac OS X Lion that just came out, it's even worse, because you no longer, desktop Zoom does work in Mission Control and Launchpad, but when you're zoomed in and you launch those two modes, you cannot pan the screen to see the rest of the screen. It's just locked in that one position. In order to see another part of the screen, I got to zoom out, move the cursor, which I can't hardly see in the zoomed out mode, and then zoom in again. And this is really very difficult. So please, Apple, I really do appreciate the desktop Zoom, but it's quickly becoming out of date and needs to be updated and enhanced. It has a lot of potential. So I'm going to ask somebody in Apple, please hear this plea and really improve the desktop Zoom and make it usable in every part of Mac OS X. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day. God bless.
Hey, Steven, thank you for your voicemail. You know, I think a lot of us who use the Mac, who aren't visually impaired or who don't have challenges or don't have to take advantage of the universal access stuff, it's hard for us to relate, I think, oftentimes to some of the challenges that come into play, and also to understand how much Apple has done or the kinds of strides they've taken with their universal accessibility to really make the Mac platform available to as many users as possible. And technologies like the desktop zoom feature, the high contrast features, a lot of these things are things that are often paid extras on other platforms, and Apple includes them for free. And they're available in APIs and made available to developers if they want to leverage them for their third-party apps. Unfortunately, you know, not every third-party developer thinks about universal access or accessibility and takes advantage of it, but a lot of them do. And I think a lot more on the Mac platform, maybe than on the Windows platform. And that's not to put down the Windows platform. It's just a fact that the more I talk to more people about this, seems to come to light. And so drawing this to our attention, I think, is great. And it caused me to go back in and really look at this feature and what was available and maybe try and find a workaround for you or some way to make this doable. And actually, there is a new feature in Lion that I think turns out can kind of help in this case. So the traditional desktop zoom that you're talking about that some of us are familiar with, I actually use desktop zoom a lot when I'm doing presentations to Mac user groups and things like that. I turn the feature on, and then if you hold down the control in the scroll wheel and scroll in or out, you can zoom the entire desktop. And it's great for illustrating when you're trying to show something on a projector and you really want to highlight a specific section or area of the screen. It's great for doing in presentations. And it's really in there for people like yourself who are visually impaired and maybe need to get a larger view of what's on the desktop. And you're right, I verified that when you go into the command tab, the tabbed application switcher, or into Time Machine, or into the new mission control view that's in Lion, that feature doesn't work. And so I completely understand what you're talking about. But in Lion, there is a new type of desktop zoom. It's actually called a zoom window, where it gives you a little kind of magnifier. And I think that mode can help you in this case, because in my testing, it seems to work in most of the situations you're describing. The only place I found that it didn't work was in Time Machine. So hopefully Apple will address that in the future and enable accessibility features to work inside Time Machine. But if you go into your system preferences, under Universal Access, you'll see in the Zoom tab, in the Zoom section, you can turn the Zoom on, make sure it's on by checking the radio button from off to on, and then check the little checkbox that says Zoom in Window. And that turns on the new Zoom in Window option. And what happens then is, rather than when you do the scroll wheel zoom, the desktop zoom as you're calling it, the control and then zoom in with your scroll wheel or trackpad, instead of the whole screen zooming, what you get is this little kind of magnifier window. And you can move that around the screen. And then once that's turned on, I noticed if you go into the mission control mode, it will maintain that zoom, and the zoom continues to work inside mission control. It also works when you do the command tab operation. So you can do your command tab, you can zoom in, you can see which tab that you want to click into, and then click through, and that zoom will be maintained in that little window the whole time. There's a couple cool options that you can actually do with the zoom window as well. You can control the size of it, you can control some of the positioning and the default zooming. And the way you do that is from the same control panel, you'll notice there's a little options button. And when you click on that options button, you can set where the cursor is. Change the position and the size of that window. There's a little button for that. And then you can also change the cursor style, which typically you have the system cursor, and the system cursor doesn't come up in size. I don't know. There's actually another feature built into the accessibility that allows you to change the size of your cursor. That actually might help you in this situation. You can actually make the pointer, I think, a little bit larger. And that setting is in the Universal Access mouse and trackpad settings. It's under cursor size. You can change it from normal to large. So that might help. But another thing that is in the new zoom options is the ability to have that in the little system cursor in the window be a crosshair. And when it's a crosshair, it's much larger and I think much easier to see. So that might help you out also just using the zoom in window rather than the traditional zoom, the desktop zoom that you're used to. And I think that might help you out. So play around with those settings, see if that works for you. Again, I verified that it doesn't seem to work in Time Machine. Now, interestingly, it does seem to work in Versions, which to me looks and feels a lot like Time Machine. So maybe there's hope that Apple can roll that into the Time Machine code and make that more accessible for you. But until then, play around with those settings and see what you think. And I'd love to get more feedback. Also, if anybody else uses the accessibility features and knows something else that I haven't thought of that might help out Stephen, please let me know. Send your email, your comments, and we'll try and get those passed along. But that's it. That's everything that I have for you today. A lot of Lion tips and tricks. If you've discovered any that I didn't cover in the show, please send those along. Send your feedback and your emails. I'll give you that information here in a second. But before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, this is a great place. If you have old electronics gear, video cameras, camcorders, digital cameras, stuff like that, and you want to get some cash for it, and you don't want to deal with the hassles of auctions and online sites and classifieds and stuff like that, try Gazelle. You can just do a simple search and answer some questions about condition of your product, and then they will give you an offer, a cash offer for that product, even pay shipping in some cases. And it's really quick and easy to do, and you can get cash for your old stuff. So that's at gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, great application for taking notes, jotting down thoughts and ideas. You can get more information and details as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile Software, check out PDF Pen Pro, very valuable application that I use each and every day, along with their other great apps, Text Expander, Disk Label, all good stuff. And you can get trials and more information over at smilesoftware.com. And Furonics, makers of Deep Freeze and PowerSave Mac. I should mention that Deep Freeze was just updated to 5.0. It has full Lion compatibility. So if you are a Deep Freeze owner, if you've been thinking about Deep Freeze and you want to upgrade to Lion, no worries there. They got you covered. And you can get more information, details, and trials over at Furonics.com. And a huge thank you to all of my sponsors for their continued support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for continuing to support the show and listening. If you'd like to support the show even further, great way to do that is to become a MacCast member. I already mentioned that I just did a show all about how I did my Lion upgrade, how I did my clean install, went into a lot of the nitty-gritty and details. If you'd like to get that and a whole bunch of extra content, more content each week for just a couple bucks a month, you can get information and details on that at member.maccast.com. And I'd love to have you become a MacCast member. If you're already a member, thank you for your support of the show. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, questions, thoughts, ideas, anything you'd like to share with me, please send your emails to maccast@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to put in an audio comment, you can do that by simply recording something on the built-in recorder on your iPhone, your iPad, or in GarageBand. It's another great way to go and just send me the audio attachment. You don't even have to convert it. Just send me M4A, AIFF, AAC, MP3. I can deal with almost any audio format you might send me, and I love getting those. To make it even easier, you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM9. Call in from your phone, landline, mobile, doesn't matter. Just leave a voicemail, and I can get your messages that way. And if you're out of the country, want to save on long distance charges, Skype is another great way to go. You can leave voicemails on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. Love to hear from you any way that you can send in your comments. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those at maccast.com. That's the website. Also there, you'll find the MacCast forum, which is a great online community of MacCast listeners answering questions and helping each other out. You'll find that at forum.maccast.com. And another couple other places you can follow me between shows, Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. And I try and keep those things really Mac-centric, more so on Facebook. Twitter, you'll occasionally get a personal tweet from me and stuff like that, but I try and keep that down to a minimum. I really keep it focused on cool Mac and Apple geek stuff that I find. So please feel free to follow me there. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.